All right, we will call, it's 8:15, we'll call the Education Finance meeting to order. And I believe we have a quorum, so thank you so much, members, for being here all on time. And so do we have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, I move that we approve the concise and brief minutes from our previous meeting.
All right, thank you very much. Representative Quam moves to approve the meeting. Hearing any discussion on that? Hearing none, I will call for the votes on the approval of the minutes for January 15th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The meeting minutes are approved. Thank you very much. We had introductions last week, and we have one additional introduction today, Representative Van Zelt. Thank you so much for being on this committee. If you would just introduce yourself, a little background, and something you'd like to see out of this committee this year.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I look forward to continuing my service on K-12 finance. I just want you to know, going in, my goal is going to be to do what I can to level the playing field between poor rural property, poor school districts in greater Minnesota, in order that our kids can compete with kids that go to the Silk Stocking District.
Thank you very much, Representative Ann Zelk. In the Silk Stocking Districts, I don't know if the department breaks school districts down into that category. It's usually by student population, but at any rate, thank you very much. We'll be looking forward to that. Members, as I stated, what the plan is today is when we went around the table last Thursday, everyone was very nice to share kind of what their plans were and some goals for the committee. And if you look at number 4 on the agenda here, basically almost all of those comments really fit into 5 broad goals. And so some of you might say, well, why isn't early childhood there? I had mentioned early childhood. Or why isn't digital learning in there? I'd mentioned that. Or teacher evaluation or integration revenue. Those all are kind of means to get to these goals. So those are certainly things that are going to be discussed and talked about. But in my mind, those were more of means on how to get to these goals. So certainly, if there's members who think towards the end here, you know, there should be other goals mentioned, or maybe a means that I'd mention as a mean maybe is a goal, that's fine. We can work with that. This isn't set in stone, certainly, but I'm hoping what this does is focus the debate and helps set some priorities for this committee. And the next step to all of this after today, we're going to hear from research staff on kind of defining what these 5 areas are and all the topics that are really involved in those. But then in the upcoming meetings, what I'm looking at are those means. What are ways out there that can reach our goals? But not just any type of mean. What I'm looking for are data-driven efforts and strategies that have a track record of producing results. So in the next couple of weeks, starting next Monday, I would ask groups to come forward if you have efforts or strategies that can reach these goals that we're talking about. But they need to be data-driven, and they need to have research behind them that actually shows, and we're looking at numbers and research that shows that it will improve student performance, close the achievement gap, or reach one of these other goals. So that's the challenge and the point that I'd like to make and put out there. So with that, I think we're going to go in order that we have here, and what I'd like to do is have staff go over each of these 5 items, and then when they're complete with the overview, members, if you have questions at that point, we'll stop after each one, take members' questions, and then we'll move on. And I think you'll have handouts for all these areas, so I'll have staff also move or direct you towards those handouts too. So we'll start with Ms. Larson under A, Support Student Performance and Reduce the Achievement Gap. Ms. Larson, thank you for joining us today, and please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, good morning. In your packets, you should have a one-page sheet of paper with three tables on it. The first table has high school graduation test outcomes by ethnicity. The second table has high school graduation rates by ethnicity. And the third has remedial instruction. And I could have taken any one of many, many tables or charts to essentially make the same point. And that is that if you look at the MCA and grad test outcomes by ethnicity, you'll see that in Minnesota, Minnesota's white student population does very well as compared to many of the other ethnic groups. And the same thing could be said for the high school graduation rates. If you look, for example, you'll see that all student graduation rate in Minnesota is 77%. But for Native Americans, it's 42%, which, according to the Department of Education, is literally the worst graduation for Native Americans in the entire U.S. For black students, for example, it's 49%, which, again, according to the Department of Education, is the second worst graduation rate in the country. Nebraska, in this case, is the worst. The Hispanic student graduation rate is 51%, which is, according to the Department of Education, the worst in the United States. And you'll see that economically disadvantaged students graduate at a 58% graduation rate, which, according to the Department of Education, ties Minnesota for the third worst rate along with the Washington, D.C. School districts. Then if you go down to the bottom and you look at this remedial instruction, it's not broken out by ethnicity, but if you think about the graduation rates and you see at what rates different groups of students are graduating, and then you look at the rate of remediation at all MNSCU institutions, for example, and compare the two-year and four-year institutions, you'll see that there are very high remediation rates even for those students who Minnesota manages to graduate. There are lots of ways to portray these data, but the point is that for white students, Minnesota has done very well, but for other groups of students, economically disadvantaged students, demographic groups of students, Minnesota has not fared also well. And in thinking about what these data might suggest, I put down a number of points that I thought might be worth considering by the committee. One, and perhaps a very important one, is that performance disparities among demographic groups of students exist throughout Minnesota, and they are not confined to the metropolitan area exclusively. Another point, which I think is very curious, we already know about viable strategies and programs for improving students' performance, and we have a lot of them in statute currently. For example, we know about high-quality early childhood education. We know about full-day kindergarten, tutoring, an early emphasis on reading, personalization of education, the value of choice in programs and schools, dual credit programs, a more seamless K-12 and higher education system, a clear definition of college and career readiness, the value of internships and apprenticeships that can support applied learning, the need to identify and create educational opportunities and access earlier in students' K-12 career to those kinds of opportunities, parent and community involvement, safe schools, competent and caring teachers, multiculturalism. Many, many of these things already exist in statute. And to make that point, 5 years ago, a legislator introduced a bill to look at the possibility of education reform in the context of a more seamless pre-K-14 or pre-K-16 system. And I wanted to read to you a couple of the components that the bill suggested the legislature consider in trying to make the system better. So, for example, the alignment of college placement exams and other college readiness indicators with K-12 standards and assessment, teacher professional development that improves the rigor of high school courses and curriculum, improve student counseling related to attaining post-secondary education, a more understandable and accessible student financial aid system, early and ongoing support for middle school and high school students to prepare them for post-secondary education, student intervention programs, the development of an integrated funding model that aligns with increased college enrollment, improved student graduation rates, improved college-going rates for at-risk youth, expanded student aspirations and educational attainment, and improved academic preparation. The point of this was a list that was compiled 5 years ago. This is in addition to all of these components that we have either funded or codified into statute. Another couple of points. Applied learning, vocational education, career and technical education, whatever you want to call it, has, in my opinion, been the sorry stepchild of the K-12 education system, that we've put a lot of emphasis on academics, and perhaps it has been to the disadvantage of applied learning, which for a certain segment of the population might be just what is needed to make the system work. You should be aware that accountability measures can help identify what education policies and programs work well and how best to serve students given finite or limited resources. But you have to remember that not all aspects of education are equally susceptible to precise measure. So some of the things that we want most, we may be able least able to measure. You have to appreciate that statewide tests can't and don't measure all forms of intelligence. For example, many 21st century skills, the ability to communicate effectively, collaborate, willingness to show up on time, aren't necessarily readily measured and certainly aren't part of Minnesota's content standards. The chair talked about the importance of data and data-driven decisions. Publicly reported longitudinal data that are valid and reliable are useful in analyzing student performance and establishing accountability. But remember, the student accountability measures you enact will affect what educators choose to emphasize. So, for example, if the emphasis is on reading and math, that is what gets emphasized in the schools. And we've certainly seen that since the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind in 2001. Summative tests, and a way to think of them is that they are like an annual test to summarize what students have learned during the school year, were put in place under No Child Left Behind for school accountability. They were not initially meant to measure student performance or to inform curriculum and instruction. Academic growth and proficiency are measures of school and student performance. Know that fewer students of color are proficient or make high academic growth, and the gaps in the percent of students who are proficient or demonstrate high growth do vary by district. You've probably heard a lot of discussion about multiple measures of accountability. The state was recently given a waiver under No Child Left Behind, and the department is using something called MMR measures that are part of Minnesota's waiver. There are three of those measures, proficiency, growth, and an examination of the academic achievement gap. But what you have to understand is that all three of those measures are extrapolated from a single test score. So to call them multiple measures in one sense is correct, but perhaps in another sense is not. And that is in contrast, and not to be confused with, the statutory multiple measures that we have in place currently in law. There are three of them: rigorous course taking rates, course completion rates, and measures of student engagement. One other thing to consider, there's been a lot of talk about the possibilities of technology. Overall, in my experience, the education and law have not kept pace with what technology allows. And then finally, the fellow who is the department chair of education policy and social analysis at Columbia's Teachers College recently wrote an editorial called "The End of Educational Exceptionalism." And his point is this, that not so long ago, education resulted in large part, or education policy resulted in large part, from single-purpose school boards making highly localized education decisions, localized and highly informed. And instead, what is happening is that public officials at the state and federal levels, who sometimes have much less detailed information about education and are much more susceptible to pressure to meet other demands on public funding, are the education decision makers of today. And all of these factors, I think, will come into play when you think about what is it that we're to do about the achievement gap, how we might approach it, and what performance measures we should use to determine whether, in fact, the approaches we use are effective.
Thank you very much, Ms. Larson. I think things have gotten a lot more complicated than I thought they were going to get this year. That's thank you. That is excellent. And first of all, before I take questions, Ms. Larson, could you put together a summary? You'd mentioned a number of things already in state statute that does something. Could you list that for the members in a handout?
Yeah.
Would you be able to do that, some of the things you just mentioned? Because I think that was maybe eye-opening for a lot of members here, all the things we already have in place for, you know, to deal with the achievement gap and so forth. So, I think that's in itself something we probably need to look at. So, thank you very much. Representative Daphne and then Representative Rudin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question from Ms. Larson. I'd actually like to make things more complicated. if I could, and I'm looking at particularly the high school graduation rates, but the same is true for the MCA grad test results. It assumes in the way that we assign children to these categories, American Indian, Alaska Native or Native American, Asian, Pacific Islander, like, that they only fit in one of those slots. And so, for instance, we have, I believe, the largest Somali population outside of Somalia. And yet, I can't see how they're doing because they're lumped into the black, not Hispanic, or African-American population, at which point a native-born African-American and a Somali 3 years out of the Somali student 3 years out of the transit camps in Kenya fall in the same category. Or I can't differentiate the Latino child from the low-income child who's also Latino. Does the state have this data? Do we gather it? Do we break it out so that we can see in richer detail what's going on with these different groups of students?
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Daphne, members, these data are compiled by the Minnesota Department of Education, and it is the source of the data is the department. I believe there are department officials here who could answer questions specifically about how the data are compiled.
And also, Representative Daphne, tomorrow we've got the department coming in, and we're going to be dealing with all of the data. They're going to be giving a presentation of all the data they have. That might be a better question for tomorrow, if that would be all right. Mm-hmm. And as a reminder, members, to bring your laptops tomorrow, because they're going to be looking at all sorts of data and statistics, and we'll see. It might mess up the system here, but we'll try to do as much as we can. Maybe we'll wind up with two or three going, but we'll see if it works tomorrow. Well, so have them all charged up. But would that be all right if we address that tomorrow?
You know, Mr. Chair, it reminds me of when I was teaching, the old question of will this be on the test? And I think the department can assume this will be on the test tomorrow. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you. I appreciate that, Representative Daphne. Representative Drunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was one of the ones whose goals was to address the student performance and academic achievement gap. Appreciate the data that's been shared and also Ms. Larson's comments. I did have a little handout with 4 points that I just wanted to bring up in regards to the academic achievement. Is that appropriate at this time, Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunhey, could you wait towards the end? I'd like to go through the presentations
first.
Why don't we just wait on that, and then we'll get to the members. I promise for sure, 30 to 40 minutes for members. So if that would be all right?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at this data, like all data, it's you've got questions as other representatives have brought up. I was wondering, are there other details, because we've had diversity funding for many years to try and address some of this achievement gap, graduation gap, et cetera. And I was wondering if there's been any split out of single-family household and that, you know, dynamic with graduation rates and achievement, looking at a corollary between per-pupil funding and graduation rate to have a better idea of what minimum funding floor we might need. And then on a diversity funding by district and graduation rate, even if you look at the cities of the first class, you know, it was brought up, there's a larger Somali community in Rochester where they speak, you know, I think it's 72 languages, but I know it's more than 60, and they've got a larger diversity population than Duluth, but, you know, less diversity funding, and how are they using it? In other words, let's see where similar situations work and don't. So is there that type of data? I mean, if the Department of Education had a portal where you could go and you could generate your own queries to pull out data into tables and other formats, then that would help increase the accessibility of that instead of, you know, each time you go in and testimony requesting this twist on the data. So, you know, hopefully when they come and present,
yep,
they could go over that accessibility. It's just, I like the data. It's useful. However, it does generate a lot of additional questions, and I would just would like if we could either maybe separately offline submit queries to the staff for a more complete data set on the output, or if the department had accessibility to where we could do that. And thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Quam. And I think tomorrow that, let's bring all of that up tomorrow. And I think the department will, you know if they can do that or not. And like I said, if we can, if there's data to be broken up certain ways, I think that would be great. And I think that's going to be a big focus of this committee. I think I'm hearing that the achievement gap is certainly a goal. So what are the statistics that accurately measure the achievement gap, which we're hearing all, and then, you know, what do we do about it? So let's, that's why the department will be coming in tomorrow to talk about all the data they have, and we'll find out tomorrow what they can do or not do. So I'd rather do that tomorrow than today if we could do that. So thank you. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I can wait until tomorrow's conversation.
Thank you very much. Representative Myra.
I can wait for tomorrow as well.
Very good. So. Oh, Representative Hertaus.
Thank you. My question is related to data also. I notice in the charts here, you know, percentages are percentages, but oftentimes percentages can play tricks and games. I'm curious to know exactly how many students are in the system in total numbers and by ethnic group as well, rather than just a percentage. And then it might be nice to have some data not identifying ethnicity, but what our overall graduation rates are as an entire group.
Very good. Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chairman, members, the overall graduation rate is, according to the U.S. Department of Education for Minnesota, is 77%.
Thank you.
Oh, okay, yeah. Thank you. Any, Representative Mariani?
I will say that I think what's valuable about the data, even as perhaps as imprecise or as perhaps even too aggregate in terms of not giving us a real ground level view of what's going on, which is what we do need to have, I think nonetheless it's pretty stark what it does. You know, what it tells us pretty strongly is that there are huge gaps and chasms that exists in our student population across the state. And I think for us as policymakers at this level, at state level, that should be a pretty clear beacon that guiding us in terms of what our policy work should be. But I do think, I'm hoping that tomorrow we're going to get into the much deeper, because I think there's going to be some really strong revealing information that can help us with that. But I certainly don't want the public to get a sense that we're going to wait to have disaggregated data to tell us the obvious story here, which is that there really are at least two different Minnesotas, you know, in terms of student outcomes here, and that there's a racial and income face to that. And that's obviously our big challenge in terms of how do we create, you know, equal opportunity for all students.
Thank you very much. We are going to move on from here because we do have four more other areas, and I know we're going to be coming back to this quite a bit. But before we move to the next area, we are honored and pleased to have the Future Farmers of America group here. They are here for their Ag Policy Boot Camp here in St. Paul this week. And I know we have the president here and the vice president, and this is a wonderful organization that really promotes agricultural education and leadership. And anyone up in the crowd before I call down the president and vice president here from Region 1, represent chapter from Region 1, Ada or Barnesville, Detroit Lakes, Hawley, Pelican Rapids, Euland-Hitterdahl, any of them? We have about seven chapters. Okay, nobody. Norman County, no one there, right? So, well, that's the area that I represent. So I was just wondering if some folks were from that area. But so if we could have the president and vice president come down, I know you'd like to address the group. And as you're being seated there, if the other members up there would just very quickly, starting off to the left, just say who you are and where you're from, please. Okay.
I'm Jared Lumen from the Good UFA chapter down in southeast Minnesota in the Red Wing Rochester area.
Nick Score from the Albert Lee FFA chapter down in south central Minnesota.
I'm Nathan Danger of the Forest Lake FFA chapter, so just a little bit 35.
Okay, thank you very much. And I think I will call on Shauna Conrad, who is the president of the state FFA. If you'd care to say a few words? And
yeah.
Thank
Mr.
you very much.
Thank you for allowing us to share with you this morning. My name is Shauna Conrad. I'm from the Goodhue FFA chapter, currently serving as the Minnesota FFA state president this year. We have about 30 blue jackets in the Capitol this morning, and we're super excited to be here. Those students have applied to come to Ag Policy Bootcamp to learn more about agricultural policy and just the legislative process in general. Among you today, we have six of the state constitutional officers, and we're kind of just along for the ride and really here to learn with these members as well, learn from you, and hopefully maybe you could learn a little bit from us as well. So hopefully we can catch you later, but otherwise we'll be back on February 21st for FFA Day at the Capitol. So we'll have another opportunity to learn more from you. I personally don't come from a farm. I grew up living in town, and my first connection to agriculture came as a seventh grader when I joined the National FFA organization. And throughout my 7 years as an FFA member, I've grown a passion for agriculture that I never thought I would. And I'm currently studying to be an agricultural educator and hope to come back and potentially teach in the Minnesota area. And FFA really, it provides a place for everyone, no matter what your background is. And through agriculture education, instills in you premier leadership, personal growth, and career success. Great organization to be a part of, and we're very excited to be here this morning. Thanks again.
President Conrad, thank you very much. We now have Vice President Marjorie Schlepper.
Schlepper,
all right. Thank Vice you. President, please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm from UPSLA. I'm serving as the State Vice President, as the Chair said. My connection to agriculture actually came through agricultural education. I grew up on a small hobby farm in rural Minnesota with horses, dogs, and cats. But where it all started to actually make sense was in that agricultural education classroom. In seventh grade, when I enrolled in my first ag ed class, that's where everything I was learning in my math, my science, my reading, English, that's where it all made sense. I realized why it mattered to me now, I realized why it would matter to me in my future career, and I realized how it all worked together. And that was really a really cool experience for me. And I had many classmates who they did not get their core subjects. They didn't understand why it mattered to them at that point. And, I mean, I'm guilty of, I was the student that in my math class would study it really hard for the test, and once test came, it was gone. I couldn't recall any of it because I didn't see how it applied. But agricultural education with the hands-on portion really made it all connect and come together. And agricultural education works very, very closely with the FFA. Actually, FFA is intra-curricular with agricultural education. But just as a reminder, what Shauna said, we'll be back February 21st, FFA members from all across the state, probably some from Region 1 as well. And we would love to have time to sit down and talk with any of you. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for your leadership and involvement, and thank you, Liz, for being here. Representative Hertaus has a question.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to add for those legislators who maybe didn't get a chance to go over to the FFA reception last night, how particularly struck I was with how bright and articulate you are as representatives of your group. These young individuals would engage each of the legislators and ask them questions about the concerns and issues facing agriculture. And that was really impressive to me, and it speaks to what you will be in the future for our country and for our nation. Many of us as urban residents and urban students don't realize where that McGrilled chicken sandwich came from. And lastly, I'd like to just close in letting everyone else know that FFA does not stand for Father Farms Alone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Representative Selden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I don't want to make you jealous, but as you all know, I'm probably representing Southern Minnetonka and Northern Eden Prairie now, but I am from Winsted, Minnesota, and I am so happy to see that one of the state constitutional officers is from Winsted, and please say hello to everyone back home for me.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for being here today, and have a great rest of the boot camp, I guess.
Thank you.
So, all right, thank you. Next on the agenda, we're going to move to funding. Adequacy is another area. So is that Mr. Strom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. There's a 30-page stapled document that says the Bush School at the top of it. That's a working paper on measuring educational adequacy in public schools. That's the document I'm going to refer to in the short section about educational adequacy. This is probably the first time I've ever talked about anything at the committee hearing without a printout in front of me. But the goal is to talk about the goal of education adequacy and not get right into the numbers. We'll have plenty of time for that starting Thursday and later. What I'd like to do a little is define a term for you and then talk about some of the different ways that we go about measuring education adequacy. Education adequacy is a term used to describe whether a state school finance system is providing funding necessary to meet its objectives. There are different definitions of adequacy, many different ways of measuring it as well. The report that's in front of you does a good job of explaining three of the main measures to measure adequacy. In some ways, though, you don't need to get to that level to think about adequacy. Representative Anzelt mentioned that he would prefer that the funding in his district compare that to that of yours in Representative Marquardt's district, the silk stocking area of Dilworth. And so we can certainly look at a printout, and we can see that funding may be higher or lower in Dilworth than it is in International Falls. And then the question becomes, what does that mean to us? How do we know what that means? Do we know whether there's similar opportunities, similar outcomes, similar educational processes taking place if we simply know that Dilworth's getting $8,000 per student and International Falls is getting $7,000 per student? So these different measures of education adequacy, what they are tools that are designed to help us get a little more insight into whether or not a level of funding is adequate. Adequacy studies are oftentimes done to evaluate a funding system in as a precursor essentially to changes in that system.
Anyone in the audience? audience. I don't know how far that goes. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So educational adequacy studies can be either done as a precursor to changes in a funding system. Some of you who were here about 10 years ago may recall that then-Governor Pawlenty undertook a large adequacy study, brought in some consultants. The legislature was involved in that as well to try and define what an adequate level of funding would be. Other times, adequacy is used as the basis for school funding lawsuits. And I don't want to get too far off track today, but much of the research actually is related to those states where educational adequacy lawsuits have been brought. And in those circumstances, a group of districts is essentially trying to show that the system is unfair to them and that the level of funding they're getting in that district or group of districts is not adequate compared to the system as a whole. When we talk about educational adequacy and the studies that are mentioned in the Bush document here, there's three major kinds that are often used. The first of those is something called an average expenditure study. And that's simply something where you're comparing the mean or median level of funding of an individual school to that of a region or the state. Sometimes those average studies look at the change over time. So, for example, some of the work that's been done in Minnesota has taken a point in time, 2003 for some of those studies, 1993 for others, and said, well, what's happened to our funding over time? Adjust for inflation, assume that the funding was adequate at this point in time, what's happened since then? So they can be longitudinal like that over time. They can compare across districts. So, for example, somebody could look at the funding for the metropolitan area and say for the school districts in the 7-county metropolitan area, here's how their funding, the average level of funding looks, and here's how it looks for folks in the other 80 counties in greater Minnesota. A second way that educational adequacy can be evaluated is through something like a resource cost study. This is essentially a model that uses inputs. It looks at resources like teachers, like the staff, space requirements, technology, and by looking at those inputs, uses one of several methods to evaluate whether the expected amount of resources is essentially a fit for the level that's actually being provided. So, for example, in the study that was done in Minnesota about 10 years ago, that was a form of a resource cost model where there was essentially a professional judgment committee set up. That group of experts looked at a variety of systems and said if a system has these student characteristics, this level of funding and this level of teachers and this level of technology, what would be needed to provide an adequate level of funding. We didn't actually have a final conclusion to our professional judgment approaches in Minnesota from 10 years ago, but there was a lot of research done on that basis, and at that time, the result of that professional judgment model was to say identify the amounts that those committees thought should be put into the system. Finally, there's a third method that's not entirely unlike the resource cost model, and that's something called a cost function study. And that's simply where some sort of essentially production function is designed that links the actual expenditures to the educational outcomes. Now, one of the problems, of course, that we have is that expenditures is a well-known number, but educational outcome is a very difficult thing for us to measure. For example, is it the reading score? Is it a math score? Is it more than one set of scores? And if so, how do we make a numeric number out of that set of scores? So even though we can, from a distance, take a look at a system and say, gee, we know that outcomes are being met or not, it's very difficult sometimes to boil that down to a number or a set of numbers where we can define what the outcomes of a system are. For example, on the first sheet that Ms. Larson gave us today, there's a table in the middle that talks about the four-year graduation rate. Many would say, well, gee, that's a very good measure to have. But some might argue, well, in some states, there's lots of emphasis on having kids graduate even if they don't graduate in 4 years. Maybe there are credit recovery programs or ALC programs or other programs that are designed to get students to graduate even beyond that four-year time frame. If we're measuring a four-year graduation rate only, then all of those activities essentially aren't showing up in a cost function as to an effective system of education. And we may find that, gee, that five-year graduation rate is an important important thing. Having those kids graduate even a year later than their normal year is a good thing. So it's difficult when we design these cost functions to find the measures that actually are reflecting the outcomes that we desire. Finally, on educational adequacy, if you turn to page 28 of this document, there's a real nice list here, and I won't read this list for you, but you can look through this list on table one about the types of adequacy analysis, and what it basically does is it talks about each of these different measures and gives you a sense of what you'd need to determine, and then what methodology you'd use to evaluate a funding system. So in summary, when we talk about educational adequacy, we're really talking about how does your funding compare to my funding, but the way we try and do that is in some sort of systematic way where we can say, gee, here's a reason why a set of districts may need more funding, and here's a reason why other districts might need additional funding in a particular area. And of course, all of these are just mathematical tools and can be used in any number of different ways, but aren't really the answer. You as committee members are going to be talking about what that adequacy level is, but these three methods of computing adequacy are just designed to give you a sense of whether a system is meeting its goals or not.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stroman. On Thursday, if I'm not mistaken, we're going to be looking at statistics on per pupil funding for every school district in the state?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, committee members, on Thursday, Ms. Johnson and I will be providing an overview of education financing, and we'll give you the first couple of printouts to look at, give you a chance to look at how your districts compare to others, and then we can talk about some of the reasons why that's the case, and you can be thinking about those as you think about what your goals are for the committee for the year.
Okay. Thank you very much. I would like to complete this portion by 9:15, so we have a full 30 minutes for members, so any questions on this part? All right. We're going to thank you very much. We're going to move to funding equity.
Mr. Chair, let me hustle through this particular section. There's a single page put out by the Consortium for Policy Research and Education that I'll reference just briefly as we talk about educational equity. And in the last couple of decades, educational equity has often been used to refer to how a school's finance system compares for various classes or individuals or circumstances. So it's a much broader term than it was some 30 years ago. And the idea behind that is educational equity is used as a way to look at fairness in opportunities, fairness in treatment, or fairness in resources across groups. So we could be looking, as was mentioned by the chair earlier, we could be looking at things like opportunities across demographic groups or opportunities across geographic regions. There's a more narrow definition of educational equity that we used to use that I think provides some real helpful information, and that's what the bottom part of this sheet refers to. And those traditional definitions were how we measure equity across various groups, and part of that we referred to as horizontal equity. And what that meant was were similarly situated school districts treated the same? And that's a hard question for us to answer because it's not clear what a similarly situated district is. But when we talk about horizontal equity, that's what we're talking about. How do districts compare across our system? We can also talk about the fiscal neutrality of a system. We'll talk about how fair a system is when we compare, for example, the property wealth of communities. That's often when we're talking about equalization, we're talking about that kind of fairness. Do you have equal access to revenue? Is a levy for an additional $100 per pupil the same in International Falls as it is in Hopkins? And those are essentially tax-based equity issues. And they beg the broader question. We, of course, have a definition of tax base. We have two that we use in the school funding area. But with those definitions of tax base, of course, we've already made some modifications to not just market value, but there's a bigger question then is whether or not the property wealth of a community really reflects what we'd consider wealth or consider something that we should put an equity measure against. One of the common arguments you'll hear in this committee is yeah, but. And the way that argument often goes is that folks will say, well, gee, the Roseville School District has a very high property tax base per pupil. A small district in rural Minnesota may have a very low property tax base per pupil. But somebody might then argue, yes, but is that $300,000 house in Roseville the same as a $30,000 house in Holly? And so the educational equity question is also one where our measures, our terms of measurement, are things that we have to be careful with. And generally, we will be referring to property wealth, but that really doesn't tell us all the story about a community. It simply tells us the size of its tax base, but that's a very important measure when we look at equalization in our school funding system.
Thank you. Any questions at this point? Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, when we see the data tomorrow organized by school districts, if you'll make any effort to apply any of these tools in a broad way, simply to show us. My concern is, I think typically we focus on the dollar amount per pupil, and that causes a great deal of political angst over inequities. And yet you're raising a whole range of concerns about a variety of other pieces of data one ought to look at in making that determination. And so I'm wondering if at least there'll be an effort when we look at the data to look at it through some different lenses.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Sprout? Representative Briner, we'd be happy to do that, and we'd encourage you as committee members to ask us to include measures that you would like to see as we present data to this committee. One thing I think you'll find tomorrow is the department has a tremendous amount of raw data on its data systems, just an absolute wealth of data. However, we're always in the business of trying to boil that down into something that fits on a printout that we can pass out here at the committee table. So, for example, when we pass out the general education printout on Thursday and begin talking about that, you'll see that there's 15 columns of data on there, or however many, which makes a pretty wide printout. But if we were to add, for example, a poverty measure on there, percent of students eligible for free and reduced lunch, we'd be happy to do that. Some of the measures, we have good measures for. We know student demographics very well. We don't know income statistics by community very well, by school district community, but we can certainly try and add whatever columns members think would give them additional help as we're looking through these printouts.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll move to the next area, which is special education adequacy. Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, just very quickly, we'll talk about special education funding in detail. In your packet today is last year's special education cross-subsidy report. There'll be a new report coming out in the next little bit from the department. This report's an excellent document that the department puts together that looks at both the expenditures for special education and the revenue for special education. And what this document does is let us see how those how that gap between revenue and expenditures compares for each school district. Now, a couple of things I'd like to measure as I'd like to mention as you're thinking about the goals for a special education funding system that complicated a bit when compared to our regular general education system. And here are a few of those problems. And these don't relate to whether we should be doing special education or not. It's simply a question that puts us in a different position than with our general financing system, where it's really all a state system. The first of those is that there are federal mandates, many federal mandates, for our special education system. So what we're designing is essentially a state funding program to wrap around both a federal and state mandate and a federal funding system. We'll talk later about the difference between the level of federal funding that's being provided for special education services and the goal that the federal government set back when it created the special education funding model later. So we won't get into that too much. But it is an area, unlike our general education area, where we really have complete control about how to do things. On the special ed side, we've got a bit of a different situation because we do have a federal mandate, we do have federal funding, and we do have a federal maintenance of effort requirement that complicate what we do with our special education formulas. One other issue I'd like to mention as we think about our goals for special education funding, we have a choice system in Minnesota that allows all sorts of student choice, things like charter schools and open enrollment and that kind of thing, and that's overlaid on top of our special education mandate, which essentially holds the resident school district responsible for any unfunded special education costs. That's an issue we'll be hearing about, I'm sure, this session. But another issue that that complicates our special education funding system is that the ultimate organization on the hook for special education funding in Minnesota is the resident school district where that child lives. Finally, our special education system is something that's a cost reimbursement, a partial reimbursement formula, and it's not a pupil-driven system, which is very different from most of our other formulas, which are essentially a per-pupil-driven system. Instead, special education is a cost reimbursement system where we're reimbursing a part of each district's spending on special education. I know we want to keep this discussion short, so we'll come back to this, but I'd encourage you to read the first few pages of the cross-subsidy report to get a sense of where Minnesota's special education funding is at compared to its expenditures.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Strom on the special education adequacy? If not, we're going to move to kind of the fifth overall general goal we heard the other day, and that's pay back the shift. Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I want to point your attention to two handouts that should be in your packets. The first is a document called State Education Funding Accounting Shifts. This was put together and drafted in its entirety by my esteemed predecessor, Greg Crow, and so I don't take any credit for it, but it's a wonderful document that is very comprehensive in including all of the history and kind of some data examples and just a really good summary, and I'll be talking about some of the high points from that throughout this discussion. I'll try to keep it brief, too. The second is a one-page summary of the shifts, the historic shift percentages as they've existed since 1982, so it's just another good reference document. So before I get into what the current shift percentages are and how much the state needs to pay back the schools, I wanted to talk about some basic terminology related to the shifts that really drives this discussion. So you all know schools in Minnesota are funded by a combination of state aids and local property tax levies. That levy aid split has varied over time, and in the early 2000s, the state took over the general education levy, and at that time then, the state share of funding for schools went up significantly, as high as 86.7%. Currently, it's declined and is around 77% of total school funding and 23% at local property tax. First definition I wanted to discuss was the concept of the aid entitlement. This is the amount of revenue needed to fully fund a formula, and the most common idea of entitlement you would think of is the general education formula allowance. That's the $5,224 that we allocate per pupil for funding, and that's a very significant share of the school's overall funding. There's also categorical aids, and Tim and I will get into more detail about those on Thursday, but when the forecast is updated every February and November, the department projects enrollments and program eligibility to kind of to see where the entitlement is going to be based on those projections. And there are adjustments made at the time of the forecast for example, lower than expected enrollment growth. The next concept is the appropriation. This is the amount of state aid that is appropriated in a fiscal year for the formula. Your job as legislators is to balance the budget and appropriate funds to fund all things, including education. The Constitution of the state says that no money can be spent from the Treasury except by appropriation. So one caveat here is that not the appropriation and entitlement are not generally equal, and I'll get into a little bit about why that is in just a moment. As we think about the timing of aid payments, two other definitions bear explanation. One is the current year payment, and that seems pretty basic. Current year is funds are received by the school district during the current fiscal year or school year. Currently, we're in fiscal year 2013, which started on July 1, 2012. And school districts and the state are on the same fiscal year, so that that helps. I believe counties and cities are on a calendar year basis, but the states and school districts are on the same fiscal year basis. And then there's what's called a final payment, and the final payment is the payment appropriated in the year following the current year that helps to fully fund the entitlement. And the reason that the entitlements are split up in this fashion is because the current year entitlement is based on estimated data. So at the beginning of the year, there may be different fluctuations or declining enrollment or other factors that can't be foreseen before the end of the year. So at the final payment of the year is used uses actual values. So in a typical situation where there's a no-shift situation, a school district would receive 90% of its entitlement in the current year and 10% in the following year. It also allows so that there aren't any significant negative adjustments at the end of the year for the school districts, which could be very problematic. Another important general concept to discuss with regard to the shift is the method of accounting that the state and the school districts use. The state, they are different, and the school districts use what's called an accrual basis of an accounting, where revenues and expenditures are counted in the year in which the obligation is created. So, for example, if a school district's aid entitlement is $1 million for the current year, it counts that $1 million as revenue for that current year, regardless of when the state actually gives them that last set of dollars, or, you know, if it withholds those dollars until the next payment year. In contrast, the state uses a cost basis of accounting, where revenues and expenditures are counted based on when the obligation is actually paid. So you can understand by withholding a greater percentage of the school district's aid, this allows the state to borrow on a short-term basis in order to make their financial position look better, because they delay the payments out. The split of payments is changed so that a larger portion of the payments are made in the subsequent year. So, for example, if a payment shift is converted from a 90-10, where 90-10 is considered to be no shift, to a 60-40 scenario, a $1 million entitlement would have 60% provided in the first year, or in the current year, and 40% in the final. So this results in a one-time savings to the state, because the state is able to write the appropriation in such a way that the payments don't equal 100% of the entitlement for the year. So getting back to that example of the 90-10, in a typical year, you would receive 90% in the first year, 10% in the, you know, as the cleanup payment. But in a year in which the shift is instituted, and for example, what actually happened during this last budget cycle, the payment shift went to 60%, and so 60% was paid in the current year, and only 10% in the following year. So that equals only 70%. So the difference between that 70% and 100% of the entitlement that the school district should have received was a one-time savings to the state. And like I said before, school district revenues, they don't change how they account for their revenues based on when those final payments come in. I think I was also going to talk in depth about the property tax recognition shift, but it's similar in mechanics in that the state requires the districts to recognize payments for so that they're able to delay state aid by having them recognize the levy in the current year instead of the fiscal year when it is usually done. So that brings us to the current situation, and as we're all well aware of the budget challenges that we faced in the last couple years, part of the 2012-13 budget solution was to significantly change the percentage of funding that the schools get. And we did go to a 60-40, and this created a one-time savings of approximately $2.1 million. Due to we're not at that rate anymore, and I'll get into a little bit of that. Due to legislation that was enacted in 2004 that prioritized any projected surpluses for the biennium would be prioritized to pay back, and there were four categories. The first was to fund the state's cash flow account. The second, to replenish the budget reserves. Third, to pay back the school shift, and fourth, to repay the property tax shift. So since enactment of of the 2012-13 budget. Budget projections have improved. Revenues have been exceeding projections in some ways, and spending has been less to create these surpluses, or not surpluses, but you know, anticipated additional revenue than what was forecasted originally. And so in February of last year, there was enough surplus to be able to put the to complete the finishing of the replenishing of the reserves and also pay $313,000 back to the shift. And so that the aid percentage went from 60% to 64.3%. And then you'll recall this last November, the latest forecast that came out, there was a projected $1.3 billion additional. And so that automatically triggered that the funds would go to pay back a portion of the shift, and now we're at 82.5%. So I don't have a crystal ball to tell you what is going to happen with the forecast that's coming out next month, but one kind of shorthand for calculating how much that the cost is that for every 1% in shift buyback, the cost is approximately $70 million. So that's a kind of a shorthand for understanding that. And we have approximately $1.1 billion remaining. So.
Ms. Johnson, thank you. Any questions on that? And we'll be certainly coming back to that, too. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Johnson. So the 2004 law requires the I just want to be real clear, it requires the payment, the payback of those four categories in those priority orders.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Right. And then, Mr. Chair, the is there a set? I think there is, but I forget. Is there a set amount that's the reserve amount? I think there is, but
Mr. Chair,
what is that?
Representative Mariani, I believe it's like $653 million, if I'm correct. So.
And then, Mr. Chair, the final question is, in order for us to do, to have a continuation of shifting, if you will, I'm not sure I'm asking this right, it would require proactive action on the part of legislature. Is that correct?
Correct.
There's no automatic shifting that was put in place. We would have to be proactive about using that instrument again. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Ms. Johnson, and wouldn't the clarification be there that for this current biennium of 12 and 13, that's automatic?
Yes.
That's in law. But looking ahead to 14 and 15, there you would take some proactive law or action.
Or if you wanted to, Mr. Chair, if you'd wanted to make them full for, you know, earlier than the 14-15, you could put that into the budget, and it'd have to be enacted before the end of the fiscal year.
Very good. Well, staff, thank you so much for this overview of areas. And I, first of all, before we take further comments, are there other general goals that you think has not been covered, a general goal that should be included on this list? And if after this meeting, if you think of some, feel free to add those and bring those before the committee. All right, I will open this up for discussion. Representative Gruenhagen, I know you've been patiently waiting there. You've got something you'd like to pass out and discuss?
Yeah, so, thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I think the page has something, or pages.
Sure, I'll try to complete this in just a few minutes here.
You bet, thank you.
It's just informational. The handout pertains to the student performance and reducing academic gap. I think, number one, if we're going to address that, I think we have to consider alternative paradigms. What I mean by that is to keep doing the same thing over and over and over again that we've been currently doing isn't producing the right results. I think we all agree there's a problem there. And so therefore, we have to look at alternative ideas that might address the problem. That's the purpose of this handout. Now, my ALA typed it up late last night, or towards the end of the day. She made a few typos, so I'd just like to correct those first. Under number two, consider cost per pupil. It should be unit, not the word until, okay? Also, under number three, should insert the letter or the number 4 period day, 6 period day, 7 period day. Okay, I'll just make a couple quick comments on each item, and then we can go from there. Number one, I think it's vitally important to to understand the impact and cost of promoting self-actualization in our public schools. These techniques were developed by Dr. Abe Maslow and Dr. Carl Rogers. I had the good fortune to correspond and work with someone who worked with Dr. Maslow and Dr. Carl Rogers in the development of self-actualization, sometimes called feeling-centered decision-making programs, in the public schools in the late 50s and early 60s. This concept is in many of the social programs that are promoted in our public school system. Now, I don't think it's important that you agree with me as far as my concern about self-actualization, but I think on an educational committee it's important to understand the concept and how it's promoted in the public school. Okay? And I have specific curriculum examples I can show you that help you understand that idea. Number two, examine three approaches to teaching reading. We all agree that literacy is a very high priority. I've listed the three that the three primary ones used to teach English in our state and nation: intensive systematic phonics. The second one is basal literature, which is the most popular right now, which is a form of whole language sprinkled with phonics. And the final one, C, is whole language. I think we need to consider the cost per pupil unit and the effectiveness. Just one brief comment. In the 90s, the U.S. Department of Education did a study on the effectiveness of intensive systematic phonics programs versus whole language-based programs. Their conclusion at that time was to teach a child to read by the fourth grade fluently with intensive systematic phonics cost about $30 per pupil unit. To teach them with a whole language approach, it costs about $214 per pupil unit. Now, I have the documentation on that, but I just throw that out there for one of the reasons why we need to look at this in terms of financing. The third discussion is to discuss the structure of K-12 and how we deliver it. Specifically, and that should be 7 through 12, not 9 through 12. Another typo there. The 4-period day versus a 6-period day versus a 7-period day, and the cost effectiveness. When I was on the school board, we were in a declining enrollment rural school district. We were habitually running SOD, statutory operating debt. We wound up about $750,000 for a small district. That's quite a bit. And we were headed towards $1 million with the state threatening to come in and take over our school district, its finances. Well, we got a superintendent in. We tried a couple of referendums. They both failed. And he said, we're going to solve this problem. And one of the things he did, he moved us from a 4-period and a 7-period day, and there's pros and cons on some of that, to a 6-period day. We saved in our school district about $300,000 per year in operating costs by going to a 6-period day. Again, there's pros and cons. But there, by looking at the structure of education, we need to understand that there's huge cost to the way we decide to deliver the educational product to our students and in our school districts. And finally, number four, examine mental health issues in public education, especially the practice of labeling and drugging young children and the possible negative side effects of this practice. I just make one comment there. One of the things I found in researching this is that in our military, if children are on psychotropic drugs past 12 years old, they cannot get into the military. That is what I read. Well, then I had the good fortune to be able to, in our Rotary Club, hear a presentation by a military recruiter, regarding this. And I asked him the question, is that true that you can't get into the military if you're on psychotropic drugs past 12 years old? And his answer was yes, however, we can grant a waiver. Okay? And I said, well, why is that? He said, well, one of the side effects of the long-term drugging of young children with psychotropic drugs past 12 years old, one of the negative side effects, is violent outbursts of uncontrollable rage. I'll repeat that. violent outbursts of uncontrollable rage. Now, in the military, do you want a soldier to have a weapon with the possibility, armed weapon with the possibility of having uncontrollable violent outbursts of rage? Okay? I'm just throwing that out for you to think about. And that really needs to be looked at, because I think the long-term drugging of young children has serious consequences for our children. And I think everybody on this committee cares about the children, or you wouldn't be here today. Two other quick things I'll just throw in. One, the gifted and talented concept. I voted against gifted and talented programs in our public school. You know, people say, you voted against gifted talent? Well, the reason I did, all children have gifts, talents, and abilities. Some more, some less. Some show them at different ages. But every child has gifts, talents, and abilities. And to send the message that a small percentage of our children are gifted and talented and the rest aren't is a disservice to our children in the public school. If you want me to repeat that, I'll say that again. And last thing, and Representative Quam alluded to it, I think we need to study the breakdown of the traditional family and its impact on our children academically and our public schools, and especially how the government has undermined the traditional family in this state and nation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep, thank you very much, Representative Gruenhagen. I do think you bring up some very important principles for the committee, and that is, I think we have to look at everything. I mean, I think, look at new paradigms. And, you know, you're talking about structures and cost and effectiveness. I think those are very important things that we need to talk about here in this committee. Also, on the point on mental illness, I know Representative Mallory, the committee he chairs on early childhood development, is holding hearings today and Wednesday on mental health issues. At 4 o'clock, thank you, Representative Myers. So that's at 4 o'clock today and tomorrow. So for those who would be interested in sitting in on those meetings, those are today. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity for us to walk through the goals today. I think it's certainly very helpful. Staff did a great job of walking through historically what has happened and giving us some detail there. And I guess I want to start off on a very bipartisan note by saying again, paying back the school shift is our number one priority as well, and I'm glad to see that House File 1 was that attempts to do that. But I understand that you know, this is going to be an uphill battle paying back that shift. So I don't envy you in carrying the water to make that happen. As we were at AMSD last week, and the question was asked, how many people in the room think paying off the shift should be a priority? I think you and I, and maybe three or four other people, raised our hand. So I'm not sure that you know how easy that will be, but you have our commitment to helping you do that, and I think that is the right thing to do. In fact, I think even in the Senate, there seems to be a little bit of dissension there as well about paying back the shift. So I recognize it's going to be a tough uphill battle, and you've got our support on that. The second thing I'd like to talk about a little bit is, I understand what we're doing here with the committee goals. We can't get into too much detail here. But I think part of what we want to do here is make sure that our teachers have the adequate resources and tools to do what they need to do as well, that we have the most highly effective teachers and motivated teachers in our classrooms, and that our funds really do focus on the classroom and not on paperwork and paper pushing and the bureaucracy. And I think that that's another area that is easy to talk about and more difficult to implement, but I think it's an area that we definitely have to look at as a state. And along those same lines, I agree with Representative Mariani, and I'm going to put some words in your mouth, so I apologize for that. That's never a smart thing to do, but I'm going to do it anyway. Too often, I think we can't see the forest for the trees, that we get really bogged. I think we can't see the forest for the trees, that we get really bogged down in, well, what does this mean, and what does this mean? And we get to the point where we're at the end of session, and we really get nowhere. So I think you've got good advice there, Representative Mariani, that it's clear we have an achievement gap. And so what are we going to do about it? And we can continue to talk about and slice and dice and figure out what the different areas are. And that's an important conversation to have. But we can't lose sight of the forest, and that is we have an academic achievement gap. And what are we going to do about it? So I certainly think that you're on the right track there. An area that we may have a little bit more dissension about as I go down the list is maintaining local control as well. And that includes the levy, the tax levy as well as on mandates, and we may find a little bit more bipartisanship when it comes to the mandates. But if you talk to your school districts, I would imagine that at least one of their either their first or second issue that they bring up is mandates. And why is it that you tell us we have to do these things and then you measure us on it and then you tell us we didn't do it right? So I always like to tell people, this is the problem with the system today. The problem with the system today is we in St. Paul and even Washington, D.C., again, we can all agree that Washington, D.C. is a bigger problem than we are. But we say, this is how we want you to do it, schools. This is how we want to mandate it. This is what you have to do. And then you do that, and then we turn around and say, now the results aren't there. What did you do wrong? And that's not the right way to do this. I certainly would, in a perfect world, we'd have school systems with complete autonomy to do what they want and are held accountable for their results. And I think that is the model we should be heading towards, because we've got very gifted and talented administrators, very gifted and talented teachers, very gifted and talented school board members out there who know what is best for their local schools, and I think that should be paramount as well as we have these discussions. So again, Chair Marquardt, we've talked about this, but I am very excited that we're all on this committee and that we are pulling, I think, the wagon in the same direction this year, so I appreciate that.
Thank you very much, Representative Woodard. Any other comments? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the special ed front, this is a good document. One of the things that I saw in there, I was on the Zed board, which basically small districts didn't have enough critical mass to be able to supply some of the special ed programs. And one thing I noticed is that most of those were in page 29, 28, 29, towards the bottom. And they were very efficient and effective. And when we look at special education funding, one of the things we did is the federal government is very regimented and bracketed and constrained, and that didn't always match students which don't fit into those brackets. And the flexibility in the state program and funding allowed us to first fit into the federal to fund for the students, and then if there were areas that didn't quite fit their guidelines, we were able to use the flexibility in the state program to cover the funding. And I think as we look forward, that flexibility is something we need to keep in the equation. And so I just ask, when we do cover that, we keep in mind that not every student is the same. And we can make a big difference by how we allow that flexibility for districts.
Thank you much. Representative Bernardi.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to just ask you, how do you see early childhood fitting in this class? In this committee? Do you see it falling under reducing achievement gap? And we're responsible for the finance, I believe, of early childhood in this committee. It hasn't been put in another committee, as I understand, correct? It's not in early childhood. It's not early childhood finance committee, right? It's just early childhood policy.
Representative Bernardi, that's correct.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, how do you see... I think that's a big goal in our state, and I think that's where we're going to get a big bang for our buck, as we, a lot of us know in this room. Do you see that fitting under reducing the achievement gap, or how do you see that fitting into the goals of our committee?
Yeah. Representative Bernardi, that's a great question, and there was a number of things brought up, early childhood education, the local control, the flexibility, teacher empowerment, just all of these things we're hearing. I think those are all means to get to these goals, and primarily the ones I just mentioned, to closing the achievement gap. So I think, and that's going to be the next phase here, is listening to efforts and strategies that will give us the most results and, data-driven that will get us to the goals, the most cost-efficient ways to get us to the goals, the efforts that will provide the most value to do that. And and so, efforts, and I think early childhood education that has a lot of data, study after study, result after result, that shows it makes a difference, as there are other programs that also do that, would certainly plug into increasing student achievement and closing the achievement gap. So it may very well be a huge part of this committee, that's for the committee members, it wouldn't be one of the five kind of major goals. It's a means to get to one of the goals. And we could you know, we could have a list of 20 things, I suppose. But what I'm trying to do is trying to get some general areas of goals, and then as folks would come forward to the committee, they'd say, okay, my bill, House File 262, would tend to fit into the goal of funding equity or funding. So as a committee, we're focusing on the goals and the outcomes, and mm-hmm. the means will be things that you mentioned, like early childhood mm-hmm. education.
Thank you.
Anything else? Representative Slocum.
I'll be very quick, Mr. Chair. I would hope that also we would do some cross committee work with Human Services, because when we look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if a child doesn't have food, doesn't have a place to live, the parents don't know where, they're so busy they can't sit down and read to the child because they're either working three or four jobs, as many in my community are. It makes it really hard for a kid to start school with the leg up that we would like to see. And it makes them hard to finish school when they're responsible for things in their family, to take care of siblings, to do these kinds of things. So I would like to also cross committee with Human Services, because I think when we look at education, we are looking at this parameter, and it's, I think, so much bigger than that. 2 cents.
Yeah. Thank you for that suggestion. Well, thank you, members. Let me give you a little roadmap of the next couple weeks. So on Wednesday, tomorrow, we will talk a lot about data. The Department of Education will be here. We will look at everything that's out there. Please bring your laptops. We'll see if that works. It may cause problems with the system. If it does, we'll just have to shut down and go from there. On Thursday, we're looking at an overview, as Mr. Strom and Ms. Johnson had mentioned, on some of the fundings. We'll go over the spreadsheet. And when the governor proposes his budget on the 22nd, the governor, of course, will have all sorts of education dollar numbers. What we do, our staff here, is converts those numbers to a consistent spreadsheet that we will use here in the House. So throughout the year, we'll see the same. So it'll be the same numbers, but it'll be according to the House. So on Thursday, we're going to look at just kind of how to read that and get used to that type of a spreadsheet. Then next Wednesday, we will have a joint meeting with the Senate. That'd be the 23rd, to listen to the governor's budget proposal. And I believe that's here. That will be right here at this time. And then the following Wednesday, January 30th, we will listen to the governor's Education Reform Task Force recommendations. The Tuesday and Thursday meetings of the next couple weeks, we will be listening to various proposals, various efforts and strategies, as I mentioned before, that are data-driven, that have a proven record of results of meeting one of our goals. And so if there are groups out there that would like to, or in members who have know of efforts that would like to come before the committee here in the next couple weeks, please contact Shannon to get on the list. And what I'd like to do, hopefully, is to kind of group them by area. So if they come forward, we can kind of take one area one day and so forth, try to stay somewhat consistent. So that's kind of the roadmap for the next couple, 2.5 weeks. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Chair. Just as a point of clarification, I think I heard that you said the Governor's Education Reform Task Force. Is that the finance working group? Is that the one we're talking about?
I'm sorry. Yes, Representative Woodard, right, the finance reform group. Correct. Anything else for the good of the order?
Did I include everything?
All right. Bring your laptops, members, tomorrow, please. And we are adjourned until that time.